This is the Groundhog Day of my Groundhog Day. In fact, I wish I could relive it every day for the rest of my life, but I cannot. So the only way to get past it is to tell it like a story. See if that helps. This, of course, will not bring it back. It was New Year's Eve, 1995, Taos, New Mexico. All afternoon, we'd been playing football in the snow, me and my girlfriend, Julia Roberts, and a bunch of our friends. She was the biggest movie star in the world, and I was on the number one TV show. The courtship had initially been conducted via fax. Somewhere in the world, there is a stack of faxes about 2 feet long, a 2-foot-long courtship filled with poems and flights of fancy, and two huge stars falling for each other and connecting in a beautiful, romantic way. At the time, I was walking on air. I was the center of it all, and nothing could touch me. The white-hot flame of fame was mine, and I kept passing my hand through it, but it didn't burn yet. It was the inert center. I had not learned yet that fame would not fill the hole. But at the time, it filled it just nicely, thank you very much. Season one of Friends had been a smash hit, and I had basically floated into season two. I'd done Letterman. I was slated to do Leno. We'd hit the cover of People magazine and Rolling Stone magazine when they were both a big deal. Now the movie offers were coming in. Why would they not? I was getting anything I wanted. $1 million movie offers here, $1 million movie offer there. I was no Julia Roberts, but there was only one of those. Then something that only happens to famous people happened. Marta Kaufman approached me and said, "I should probably send flowers to Julia Roberts." "You mean the biggest star in the universe, Julia Roberts?" "Sure, great. Why?" I said. Turned out Julia had been offered the post-Super Bowl episode in season two, and she would only do the show if she could be in my storyline. Let me say that again. She would only do the show if she could be in my storyline. Was I having a good year or what? But first, I had to woo her. I thought long and hard of what to say on the card. I wanted it to sound professional, star to star. Well, star to much bigger star. But I wanted something a tad flirty in there, too, to match what she had said. I'm still proud of what I settled on. I sent her 3 dozen roses, and the card read, "The only thing more exciting than the prospect of you doing the show is that I finally have an excuse to send you flowers." Not bad, right? I was afraid to go to sleep at night, but I could pour on the charm when called for. But my work here was far from done. Her reply was that if I adequately explained quantum physics to her, she'd agree to be on the show. Wow. First of all, I'm in an exchange with the woman for whom lipstick was invented. And now, I have to hit the books. The following day, I sent her a paper all about wave-particle duality and the uncertainty principle and entanglement, and some of it was metaphorical. Alexa Young, a staff writer on the show, told The Hollywood Reporter many years later that Julia was interested in Matthew from afar because he's so charming. There was a lot of flirting over faxing. She was giving him these questionnaires like, "Why should I go out with you?" And everyone in the writer's room helped him explain to her why. He could do pretty well without us, but there was no question we were on Team Matthew and trying to make it happen for him. In the end, all our efforts worked. Not only did Julia agree to do the show, but she also sent me a gift. Bagels. Lots and lots of bagels. Sure, why not? It's Julia fucking Roberts. Thus began a 3-month courtship of daily faxes. This was pre-internet, pre-cell phones. All our exchanges were done by fax. And there were many, hundreds. At first, it was the edge of a romance. I sent her poems, asked her to name the Triple Crown line of the Los Angeles Kings, that kind of thing. And it wasn't like we weren't both busy. I was shooting the most popular show on the planet, and she was shooting a Woody Allen movie called Everyone Says I Love You in France. Of course she was. But 3 or 4 times a day, I would sit by my fax machine and watch the piece of paper slowly revealing her next missive. I was so excited that some nights I would find myself out at some party sharing a flirtatious exchange with an attractive woman and cut the conversation short so I could race home and see if a new fax had arrived. 9 times out of 10, one had. They were so smart. The way she strung sentences together, the way she saw the world, the way she articulated her unique thoughts, all was so captivating. It wasn't uncommon for me to read these faxes 3, 4, sometimes 5 times, grinning at the paper like some kind of moron. It was like she was placed on this planet to make the world smile, and now, in particular, me. I was grinning like some 15-year-old on his first date. We had never even spoken yet, much less met each other. Then, early one morning, something changed. Julia's fax veered romantic. I called a friend and said, "I'm in over my head. You have to come over right away. Tell me if I'm wrong." When he arrived, I showed him the fax and he said, "Yep, you're not wrong. You are most certainly in over your head." "What am I supposed to send back?" "Well, how do you feel?" "Oh, fuck off," I said. "Just tell me what to say." So Cyrano and I compiled and sent a fax that veered romantic too. Then we stood there, by the fax machine, looking at each other. 2 men just staring at a machine. After about 10 minutes, the jarring sound of the fax machine, all bongs and whirs and hissing messages from outer space, filled my apartment. "Call me," it said, and her phone number was at the bottom. I picked up the phone and called Julia Roberts. I was nervous as hell. As nervous as my first appearance on Letterman. But the conversation went easy. I made her laugh, and man, what a laugh. She was clearly extremely smart, a big intellect. I could tell already that she was easily in the top 3 of storytellers that I ever met, too. Her stories were so good, in fact, that at one point I asked her if she had written them out ahead of time. 5.5 hours later, as we came to a close, I realized I wasn't nervous anymore. After that, we could not be stopped. 5-hour conversations here, 4-hour conversations there, we were falling. I wasn't sure into what, but we were falling. It was clear that we were in deep smit. One Thursday, my phone rang again. "I'll be at your house at 2 p.m. Saturday. Click." And there we had it. How did she even know where I lived? What if she didn't like me? What if the faxes and the phone calls were all really cute, but when it came to real life, she didn't want me anymore? Why can't I stop drinking? Sure enough, at 2 p.m. that Saturday, there was a knock on my door. Deep breaths, Maddie. When I opened the door, there she was. There was a smiling Julia Roberts on the other side. I believe I said something like, "Oh, that Julia Roberts." Even in moments like this, the jokes just flew by. Craig would have said it faster, but he wasn't there. She laughed that Julia Roberts laugh, the one that could launch 1,000 ships, and any tension seemed to just vaporize. She asked me how I was doing. "I'm feeling like the luckiest man in the world. How are you doing? You should probably invite me in now." I did let her in, both figuratively and literally, and a relationship began. We would already be a couple by the time we started filming the Friends Super Bowl episode. But before we filmed it, it was New Year's Eve in Taos. It was about to be 1996. I was dating Julia Roberts. I'd even met her family. She picked me up in her orange Volkswagen Beetle after flying me there privately. I thought I had money. She had money. We played football in the snow all day. Later, Julia looked at me, looked at her watch, 11:45 p.m., took my hand and said, "Come with me." We jumped in this big blue truck and drove up a mountain, snow swirling around. I had no idea where we were going. We seemed to be heading up into the very stars themselves. Eventually, we reached a mountaintop, and for a moment the weather cleared, and we could see New Mexico and beyond, all the way back to Canada. As we sat there, she made me feel like the king of the world. A gentle snow was falling, and with that, 1996 began. In February, Julia went on Letterman, and he pressed her on whether or not we were dating. She had just starred in the Friends episode, the one after the Super Bowl. That episode, replete as it was with guest stars like Julia, Jean-Claude Van Damme, Brooke Shields, and Chris Isaac, among others, was viewed by 52.9 million people, the most watched show ever to follow a Super Bowl. The ad revenue alone was staggering, more than $500,000 for 30 seconds of airtime. The show was now solidly NBC's major cash cow. And yet, I can still recall a couple of nights thinking, I wish I was on ER instead of Friends. I could never get enough attention. The problem was still there. My fingerprint, the color of my eyes. We'd filmed Julia's part of the double episode a few days after New Year's, January 6th to 8th. They'd written lines for me like, back then I used humor as a defense mechanism. Thank God I don't do that anymore. And I've met the perfect woman. Our kiss on the couch was so real, people thought it was real. It was. She was wonderful on the show, and her chemistry seemed to seep off televisions all across America. To answer Letterman, Julia yet again proved her smarts by fucking with everyone. Yes, I have been going out with Matthew Perry, and for some reason, maybe because I did the Super Bowl show, people think it's the Matthew Perry from Friends, but in fact, it's this haberdasher I met in Hoboken. But Matthew Perry from Friends is nice too. So I don't mind that mistake. She also called me awfully clever and funny and handsome. Everything back then was a yes. Once we'd wrapped season 2 in April, I headed to Vegas to shoot my first major movie. I was being paid $1 million to star in Fools Rush In with Selma Hayek. To this day, it's probably my best movie. If I were doing that movie now, I would travel with 3 people, mostly because I'm scared to be alone. But back then, it was just me. I wasn't filled with fear the way I would be now. I think that's why they send young people off to war. They are young. They aren't scared. They are invincible. Don't get me wrong, I was nervous about making Fools Rush In. There I was, in Vegas, with a $30 million movie on my shoulders. On the first day, I was being driven home and said to the driver, "You have to pull over." He did, and I threw up from fear right there by the side of the road. On a movie, not only is the work done slower, but it also only works if you really are feeling what you're trying to portray as a feeling. This deeper work can be hard to transition to. And I found it more difficult because on movies you tend to shoot scenes out of order. I remember on day 2 of Fools Rush In, we were shooting a scene at the obstetrician's office, hearing our baby's heartbeat for the first time. I had no idea how to get the feeling for that, given that I'd just met Selma. Later, I remember there was a scene that called for me to cry. I was very scared about that, too. I thought about it all day long and worried about it all night. I ended up pulling it off somehow. The trick is easy. You think of something that makes you feel really sad. But the timing is difficult, because you have to do it at exactly the right time, and you have to do it over and over again. That day, I'd been crying all day on the set of Fools Rush In. I went up to Andy Tennant, the director, and said, "We've been doing this for 10 hours, man. I've got nothing left in me." Andy said, "We need it 2 more times, buddy." The prospect of this made me burst into tears. We both laughed and agreed there must be a little more in the tank. I actually find dramatic acting easier to do than comedic acting. I look at a scene and think, I don't have to be funny. This will be a snap. I've been nominated for 4 Emmys in my life so far, 1 in comedy and 3 in drama. But I was starting to come up with some fun strategies to tap into real feelings and to be more of a leading man than a funny sitcom actor. At noon at the Stratosphere Hotel in Vegas, they have a big fireworks show. So I told Selma to look at the hotel then, because that was how my character felt when he first met her character. Selma had tried to do her best too. She came into my trailer at the start of the shoot and said, "Let's just spoon a little bit." I did my best Chandler impression, the double take and sardonic stare thing, and said, "Oh, okay, let's just spoon a little bit." Selma always had a very elaborate and lengthy idea about how to do a scene, but her long-winded ideas weren't always helpful. There's one scene in which I'm professing my love for her. She suggested that we don't look at each other. Rather, we should look out at our future together. After listening to this nonsense for about 20 minutes, I finally said, "Listen, Selma, I'm telling you I love you in this scene. You look wherever you want. I'm going to be looking at you." Throughout the making of the movie, I'd been going through the script and pitching jokes to Andy Tennant, who was a very smart and incredibly nice guy. He sat on me. I was bouncing around doing my funny little things, and he would take me aside and say, "You don't have to do that. You're interesting enough to watch without doing that." That line of thinking allowed him to pull out of me the best performance of my career. Could this be a different way of saying, "Maddie, you're enough"? The words I've been longing to hear my entire life? Andy went on to direct dozens of movies, including Hitch starring Will Smith. Nice guys don't finish last, I guess. Andy was also open to hearing pitch ideas. One day, my friend Andrew Hill Newman was visiting me on the set and came up with the line, "You are everything I never knew I always wanted." I wrote it out and handed it to Andy Tennant, who loved it, and it's become the most famous line in the movie, and movie-wise, probably the best line I ever said. One day, during shooting, there had been a bunch of people in the background on Lake Mead on jet skis, and I asked if I could ride one during the lunch break. But this was the start of the movie, and I was told it was too dangerous. But everything back then was a yes, so I said, "You have to say yes to that." So I headed out onto Lake Mead. The sun was high. The blue water crackled like a flame. As I zoomed around on the jet ski in the distance, I could see the Hoover Dam, where the climax of the movie would be shot, and Mount Wilson hovering over everything like a warning. But everything in my life was perfect. I had the most beautiful, famous woman in the world as my girlfriend. I was on the number one TV show in America. I was making a lot of money shooting a movie that could only be a number one box office smash. I revved that jet ski hard, feeling the loose, soft connection to the water, turning this way and that, the chop bumping me up and down on the seat, my right hand turning and turning and turning, pushing that machine to its limit. And then I turned the jet ski hard right, but my body went straight on. I was airborne, and then I was not airborne. Once I surfaced, I looked back to where I started, and there stood 40 people on the shoreline, the entire crew who had been watching me risk the entire movie and who now all dove into Lake Mead to get me. When I got back to shore, I knew I was hurt. That night, there was a big scene to shoot, the birth of the baby scene, the key moment, and I had to be right for it. But everything was hurting. I had especially fucked up my neck. The crew knew I was struggling, so they called a doctor who came to my trailer and handed me a single pill in a plastic package. "Take this when you're done," the doctor said. "Everything will be fine." I stashed that pill in my pocket, and I swear to God, I think if I'd never taken it, none of the next 3 decades would have gone the way they did. Who knows? I just know it was really bad. My character in Fools Rush In is a real estate developer who drives a red Mustang. The scene that night went on and on, But just before dawn, we wrapped. I could sense the sun edging closer to the horizon. "Hey, can I drive the Mustang home to Vegas, do you think?" I asked. I'm amazed after the jet ski debacle that they said yes to anything right then. But they did. The first light of that Nevada day was creeping over Mount Wilson when I left the lot. I put the top down on the Mustang and swallowed the pill.